This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you ask most people why they like living here, quality of life would likely be mentioned. But that quality of life isn't the same for everyone, and the city of Charlotte has long been interested in studying and improving it. Every couple of years, they conduct a quality of life study to help the city determine programs and services and how to allocate resources. And this year, they are making changes to the survey in an effort to get a more accurate answer or more accurate answers, and they want your input. We're going to talk about all that in the first part of the program today with Warren Cooksey, a city councilman for the 7th District. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
You're here like every 2.5 weeks, aren't you? Seems that way. Dr. Owen Furseth is Associate Provost of Metropolitan Studies and Extended Academic Programs at UNC Charlotte. He has served as the Principal Investigator for the City of Charlotte's Neighborhood Quality of Life Study since 1997. Good to see you as well.
Good morning, Mike.
And Virginia Keough is President of the Southwest Neighborhood Coalition and a member of the City's Neighborhood Matching Grants Committee. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning. How long has... I guess I'll begin with you, Dr. Furseth. How long has the city conducted these studies?
Okay. The history of the study, Mike, goes really back quite a ways to 1993. And at that point in time, the city planning department, primarily taking the lead, was concerned about what was going on in Charlotte's inner city neighborhoods, what was called the CWAC neighborhoods.
City within a city.
City within a city, correct. And so they looked at the census data for those CWAC neighborhoods and issued a report essentially ranking them on a number of variables across economic and social dimensions. So that is kind of the starting point. In 1997, we got involved, that is to say UNC Charlotte, and we continued to use those 73 neighborhoods, but we went in a different direction, relying on local data. And we picked local data, or we focused on local data, because they were more timely, they were more up-to-date, and they represented information that was collected by city and county departments and other agencies that we felt gave us a better picture of what was going on in Charlotte. So we did that in 97, and then in 2000, we expanded the geographic scale of the report to include not just Charlotte neighborhoods, but actually the neighborhoods that would eventually become part of Charlotte, in terms of our agreements with the surrounding county or the surrounding towns in Mecklenburg County. So we went from 73 neighborhoods up to 173 neighborhoods. And we changed the variable mix. We dropped the number of variables from about 28 down to 19 or 20. And since 2000, we pretty much kept the same neighborhood boundaries, the same set of variables, so that we were able to look at data over time and do what social scientists call a longitudinal analysis, which lets us look at the same neighborhoods, the same pieces of information, see what's happening in a positive and negative direction.
How many other cities around the country do this? Do you know?
I do not know.
Do you have any idea?
Yeah, the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. has a national set of communities they work with, and there's probably about 35 to 40 who do this. But the one, I think, major difference between Charlotte and those other cities is the fact that there is a staying power with Charlotte, both in terms of the variables we use and the fact that it's consistently been done on a biannual basis.
So you've done it every 2 years since the very beginning?
Pretty much, yeah.
Now, when I say it's a survey, does that mean that you're passing out questionnaires to people who live in these neighborhoods, or are you simply looking at statistical data that you glean from other sources?
Right. We rely pretty much exclusively on statistical data. And we do that because on some occasions, if you do surveys, you might not get the proper sample. You might get people who have a certain bias because of what happened the day before to them, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So what we rely on is statistical information.
And Virginia Keough is president of the Southwest Neighborhood Coalition. And I don't know how long you've been president or how long you've been active in that area, but just from your point of view, if you can tell me, what have been the results of previous surveys? I mean, have you benefited? Have things changed over time because of what they've gleaned from these surveys?
Things have changed. I've been involved with leadership in the communities in Charlotte for about 25 years, and I've had the coalition for 5 years. But the NSAs are very informative and very important to neighborhood leaders, such as statistics for senior citizens. I was just talking to Mr. Furseth before we came in here about that, being that I am a senior citizen. That is one of my pet peeves, and that's one of the things that I do check when I look at the NSAs. Mm-hmm. There are 14 communities in my coalition, and I look at all of the NSAs to see where it can help each neighborhood and what particular things that we can take from the NSAs to help those neighborhoods.
NSAs are neighborhood statistical areas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How would you define a neighborhood statistical area?
Repeat.
How would you define that? How do you choose an area? What's an NSA?
That's probably more our statistician's definition. One of the things that we're changing to talk about, you know, the changes being made.
Yes, you're changing the titles.
One of the
neighborhood profile area.
Keep in mind, we're going to keep the neighborhood statistical area data as well because, as Dr. Furseth noted, to have that consistent quality of data over the years mm-hmm. is very important to see. But what we found as the city has grown mm-hmm. and what helped push this change is that you have a lot of NSAs that were defined, you know, 10 years ago that no longer by any stretch of the imagination could be considered a neighborhood. My favorite example being Ballantyne West and District 7, that's an area that I represent. In 2002, that NSA, as defined at the time, had a little over 2,600 people. Mm-hmm. That's fairly typical for an NSA in Charlotte. In the 2010 study, it had 11,546. That's a small town. That's not a neighborhood area anymore.
Right.
So part of the goal of this change is to break up a larger NSA like that into these smaller neighborhood profile areas so that you can still get the fine grain level of detail you need to understand neighborhoods, but we'll still keep the NSAs so that, you know, we can still compare over time.
Let me see if I understand this, because this is mm-hmm. going to be one of my questions. You previously looked at 173 neighborhood statistical areas within mm-hmm. the city. In this new study, you're expanding to 394 neighborhood profile areas that also include areas outside the city in Mecklenburg mm-hmm. County. What's the difference between a neighborhood statistical area mm-hmm. and a neighborhood profile area?
Okay. I think the simplest way to think about this, back to Councilman Cooksey's mm-hmm. point, is that these boundaries were determined back in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We've gone over a decade. It's been a lot of growth, a lot of change in Charlotte. So some of what were neighborhoods, defined neighborhoods at that point in time in 2000,
are different.
Now have grown right. so much that there's mm-hmm. there's just a complete kind of metamorphosis in terms of what's going on.
So are you subdividing, in the case that he gave, Warren Cooksey gave, are you subdividing what used to be an NSA into many NPAs?
Correct. And what we're doing is we looked at the existing geographies that are out there. So we looked at what the police identify as their reporting areas. We looked at school attendance zones. We looked at the transportation zones that the Charlotte DOT uses. And then we also looked at what the Census Bureau has mm-hmm. been producing now in terms of their new census block groups. And in 2010, they came up with a whole new, more detailed geography mm-hmm. that essentially slices and dices places into smaller groupings. And these block groups then, along with neighborhood boundaries, are being used to come up with a larger, as you said, Mike, 394 new neighborhood profile areas within the city of Charlotte.
So what do you do at the city council level with the information you get from this study every 2 years?
At the city council level, it's a general statement of policy, and then when we deal with other policies about neighborhood improvement, particularly defining infrastructure needs that we have, every 2 years there's generally a neighborhood improvement bond. The physical dimension is one of those characteristics that gets studied every 2 years. Percentage of persons with access to public transportation, with access to retail facilities, those are the kinds of things that get measured. So that translates really more into staff activity in the various departments of city government, police, neighborhood and business services, mm-hmm. fire department, et cetera. Ms. Keough, in dealing with neighborhood matching grants, I'm presuming, and I'm seeing a nod already, that looking at neighborhood statistical area data helps the neighborhood matching grants committee determine what you know, what grants to hand out for neighborhood improvement.
Because here's what I read from the information supply. You develop action plans. You determine resource allocation. Identify I don't even know what this is. Capacity building opportunities. Allow disparate groups to work together on shared goals. Neighborhood associations use the information to understand their communities and develop their own work plans. And you do this every 2 years. Every 2 years. Do things really change that much every 2 years, or is it simply to solidify what you think you already know?
Some changes are relatively modest over 2 years because it's only 24 months. In other cases, where there's been dramatic sorts of forces at work, and I'll take what's happened since the recession in 2008, we saw tremendous shifts between 2008 and 2010 in the data related to what had happened in terms of the Charlotte economy. So the degree of change and change across various variable groups will be influenced by what's happening in the larger economy, as well as, back to Councilman Cooksey's point or Mary's point, where strategic investments are made. So where the city is putting money to identify those critical areas. Sorry, Virginia.
You know, that's okay. I've been called worse. But I did want to say, going back to from the 173 area to 394, I looked at it as kind of customizing and, you know, being able to get more detail into what's going on in the neighborhoods. And this also really does help us when we're in the neighborhood matching grant committee meetings as to why we approve matching grants. Mm-hmm. And this just really helps neighborhood leaders in many, many, many ways. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it helps with just for instance, if we have a lot of senior citizens in a particular area, we want to make sure that if they need transportation, they have transportation. If there's senior citizens in a particular area and they need recreation, we want to make sure that there's recreation or center or YMCA or somewhere where they can go and kind of just relax and maybe exercise.
And that's why you're obviously in favor of these changes, and probably other people in your position in other parts of the city are in favor of them. Did you guys advocate for this, or is this something that the university or the city decided to do because it was time to change?
Well, both. Because we've talked about this as neighborhood leaders for many, many years about changes. Mm-hmm. And we welcome these changes in a big way. We welcome these changes, but it's been not so much as complaints, but discussions as to how this would help us more and help the citizens in the neighborhoods more.
In previous studies, you characterized the neighborhoods that you looked at as either being stable, transitioning, or challenged. How did you reach those conclusions, and how will this change?
Okay.
This will be fun.
Yep. What we did in the past was we used our 20 analytical variables, and we statistically manipulated the data to collapse all those into a single metric, a single measure. And then we looked at the scores on that variable across the city as a whole, and then looking at the distribution of those scores, we essentially drew a line, as you indicated, Mike, between the stable, transitioning, and challenged. One of the big changes going forward in 2012 beyond the new, more detailed geography, is we're going to move away from that single score, that single value.
Let me stop you there because we have to take a break. We'll come back and find out what you're going to do differently this time around. That's Dr. Owen Furse with UNC Charlotte. Also with us, Warren Cooksey from the City Council of Virginia Kehoe, President of the Southwest Neighborhood Coalition. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Leap Design, a full-service graphic and web design studio in Charlotte's Plaza Midwood, providing individual solutions for brand identity and website development for businesses and organizations. Details at leapdesign.com. Throughout history, veterans returning from war have suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome. They just didn't have a name for it until recently. And still, untold numbers of vets are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who may suffer from PTSD. And yet, there is still a mental health stigma attached. which may prevent them from seeking treatment. So we're joined by medical and military professionals who work with PTSD to talk about what help is available and how to access it. And we'll hear one soldier's personal story of his journey through this disorder tomorrow morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, some states are passing laws that could limit voter fraud. Others claim they are thinly disguised efforts to disenfranchise certain groups of voters. How new voting rules could shape the 2012 election.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE, your news source for 30 years.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the action plan, the city's action plan study that comes out every 2 years and the changes they're going to make in it this time around with Dr. Owen Furseth, who is the principal investigator of the Quality of Life Studies for the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, Warren Cooksey, City Council, District 7, and Virginia Kehoe, president of the Southwest Neighborhood Coalition and a member of the Neighborhood Matching Grants Committee. So in the past, you took all your metrics, manipulated them, as you say, which is an evil word, but so that you could draw lines and define stable, transitioning, and challenged neighborhoods. You're doing things differently this time.
Right. We're going to continue to collect the data, as Councilman Cooksey's indicated, but rather than trying to create a one-size-fits-all sort of line and classifying all Charlotte neighborhoods in that sort of fashion, we're going to move away from that, and we're going to look at individual variables at the neighborhood level. So that in the case of the Steel Creek area where Virginia is from, if the variables down there in Steel Creek are revolving around transportation or they're focused on the issues are elderly population, then we want to hold up those variables so that we can help inform decision-making around what's taking place down there rather than simply saying, oh, this neighborhood is stable and this neighborhood is transitioning and this neighborhood is challenged. So essentially to try and create a more personalized sort of information for the neighborhood.
And do you think this will address some of the issues that perhaps fell through the cracks in the past with previous surveys?
It definitely will, without a doubt. We'd love it. We love it because this is what we have discussed over the years, and this is one of the things that we've been striving for and asking for.
Mm-hmm.
So it definitely will help us. That's the reason why I said that when they went from 173 areas to 394, it sort of customizes or, as you said, personalize it for us. And this information can be very helpful to us and the residents in the neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Another element of this change I think will be welcoming is that while I appreciate the statistical purity that goes into identifying the three categories, stable, transition, challenging, based on deviations from, based on a certain number of standard deviations from the mean and the like. I'm a history major, not a statistician, but I know the terminology. What that in effect means on the ground is that a neighborhood can improve from study to study. But if it doesn't improve as much as other neighborhoods, it's still going to be called challenged. We have a group of neighborhoods that have been challenged, been deemed as being challenged in the past five studies.
Mm-hmm.
And this is from a policy perspective, this is a flaw in statistics where it's completely valid statistically. But if you live in a neighborhood that was deemed challenged in 02 and you've worked hard and you've tried to change the variables and you've seen some progress,
mm-hmm.
Right now, the way the study is set up, if you don't see enough progress, you're still going to be called challenged. And that's where I think going to this change about looking at the dimensions differently and creating, the way I like to phrase it is creating a sort of a baseline.
Mm-hmm.
Here is a baseline expectation of neighborhoods, and you're going to either be above it, around it, or below it. And it gives a neighborhood the opportunity to work together and to show demonstrated improvement in a study instead of perhaps always being stuck in the challenge category.
Well, you were a history major and have this understanding of statistics. I was a broadcast major. I don't know anything about this. My head's going to explode. So you're dividing these into smaller areas. They're already doing that. And so instead of using these labels of stable, transitioning, and challenged, you are then taking other. Are you looking at tinier aspects of this so that you can note change in those tinier aspects of all of this?
Sure.
So that you can see progress even if progress would not have been seen under the old labels.
Sure. To Councilman Cooksey's point, one of the things we've recognized over the years is that we've got a number of neighborhoods out there with leaders like Virginia that are just driving, and they're really kind of pulling the cart uphill.
Mm-hmm.
So things are improving in the neighborhood, but if they were not improving at the same rate as the citywide average,
mm-hmm.
then those neighborhoods were never really going to be able to move from one category to another. With this new approach, is what we're going to do is we're going to look at the absolute change in these variables at that neighborhood level, so that if a neighborhood has spent the last couple of years, say, working on opportunities for youth in the neighborhood, rather than simply merging in a larger group of variables and coming up with a citywide average, we'll now be able to say, well, what about this neighborhood where this has been the focus? What's happened in terms of youth opportunity in that neighborhood? And indeed, if there have been positive changes, let's celebrate those and let's hold that neighborhood
up. Well,
that
was going to be a question. In the old days, in the old way of doing things, stable, transitioning, challenged, was there a stigma attached to the last two categories?
Absolutely. And I was about to address that. We welcome, again, you know, the different rankings that they're going to have rather than stable, transitioning, and stable. And I have an example. To your point, Councilman Cooksey, Madison Park, for instance, by itself is stable. Montclair South by itself is transitioning.
Mm-hmm.
I have an NSA on Montclair South and Madison Park together, transitioning. So we got two or three different rankings for the same neighborhood. And if they're going to change the grading and make each one personalized or customized, as I put it, then that's going to change the way this is looked upon. And there is a stigma, especially if a neighborhood is transitioning or challenged.
And transitioning could be in either direction, right?
Correct.
Could be getting better, could be getting worse.
Yep. Right.
Because it's a kind of a nebulous title. Several years ago, as you said, Doctor, you began to look at areas outside of the city of Charlotte into the unincorporated areas of the county. Does anybody take a look at that information that you collect for the things that the city can't act upon because it's not part of the city of Charlotte?
Yes. In fact, you know, the full list of departments, not just city departments, the county, you know, health department, social services, park and rec use it. Library use it. Schools have access to it and can use it. You have nonprofits that use it, United Way, YMCA, that sort of thing. That's one of the things that I particularly like as a data geek is that this is not just simply a study that gets done and put on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes, actually, I think, to the point of why I do it every 2 years as well. Doing it every 2 years keeps it fresh in people's minds. It's not just something that gets done and is referred to, you know, from time to time when people say, oh, yeah, what about that study?
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a part of what every department that deals with neighborhoods in some way, shape, or form is the touchstone that they go to understand where they're working.
Even though go ahead.
I was just going to say, to Councilman Cooksey's point, the National League of Cities mm-hmm. a couple of years ago published a monograph on best practices, best public public policy practices around the country. And the Charlotte Quality of Life study was in there. It was the only study of its type in there. So it, mm-hmm. I think it goes to his points of utility, the fact that it is so widely recognized across the community by neighborhood groups, by nonprofits, as well as government agencies.
And even though these old labels are going away, stable, transitioning, challenged, and even though it was sometimes difficult to overcome the challenged category, even, no matter how hard you worked, like a gerbil in a cage, were things done as a result of being called challenged or transitioning? That becomes a squeaky wheel. Did the squeaky wheel get the attention of the city and or the county and the agencies that are involved in all this in the past?
I think that they did.
And are you worried then that if these labels go away, that they won't be as squeaky as they used to be?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all, because actually, I kind of work in all four corners with neighborhood leaders mm-hmm. of the county, northwest, you know, south, and east. We all kind of get together and talk about the things that we need, the differences that we have, or the things that we have that are alike. So I don't think that this will change it in any way. It'll just make it better. And so far as being challenged, This will help the challenged probably neighborhoods better than any of them.
Okay. Why?
In the reason that they are called challenged and they are stigmatized because they're saying they're challenged. And this may give them incentive to do a little bit more to actually upgrade themselves in the rankings.
In defense of the stigma of labels, I'd like to point out that in earlier versions of the study, the term that neighborhoods now called challenged were actually called threatened.
Okay. Well,
yeah, that change was made some years ago because if you think challenged is a bad label for a neighborhood,
try threatened.
You're having a series of four meetings to help citizens learn about the proposed changes in this quality of life study and to answer the question, what does quality of life mean in your neighborhood? And you had your first meeting last night for the Southeast District.
That's tonight.
It's tonight.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
tonight.
At a church on Central Avenue. What are you expecting people to say? When you ask them, what does quality of life mean in a neighborhood? What do you think it means?
You know, I'm thinking that it means to them that possibly somebody is listening. And I guess I have to put it that way because most of the neighborhoods that I deal with are inner city. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you get a feeling that people are not listening. I mean, they're not getting the things that they need in order to just live basically normal lives every day. And I go back to transportation. I go back to rec centers being nearby, libraries being closed, schools being closed, and different things like that. And these statistics will let us know that actually they just let us know what's going on in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. So there's a meeting tonight. Where's that meeting tonight?
I'm blanking on the name of the church. It's at 4012 Central Avenue.
Okay.
There we go.
I can probably
Memorial United Methodist Church.
There we go.
Yes, that's what's having.
So that's
the staff is all about.
The Northeast District meeting will be on Thursday evening at 6:30 at University YMCA on Mallard Creek Road. At the Northwest District meeting will be next Tuesday at 6:30 at Northwest School of the Arts on Beatty's Ford Road. And the Southwest District meeting will be at 6 p.m. on June 30th at the Southview Rec Center. Is this the first time you've had meetings in these various quadrants about the survey itself?
We actually had a series of meetings last fall as we kind of kicked off the revision process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who comes to these meetings?
We do. The residents in the neighborhood, they go to these meetings. All the leaders that I have talked to know about these meetings, and they're going to encourage the residents in their neighborhoods to attend these meetings. We hope that the residents will go out and just let staff know what they need, what they want, and what this means to them.
Tell me why citizen participation in this, when we have people like you who are leaders, why is citizen who then get their information from individuals in the community, why is citizen participation in a meeting like this important?
It's very important. Well, I'll just have to put it like this. It's very important to their quality of life. And, you know, that's
more
what
voices,
this is.
More voices are better than one?
Yes. That's what this is all about. You know, they often say when we're going down to city council and we have an issue or a concern, when you see butts in seats, you're listening. So we go and this is our voice. You know, we're our own advocates for these type of things.
After these meetings are over in the next 2 weeks, is that when you launch the study or are you collecting this information throughout the year every year?
We have an ongoing research process, so we are collecting data all the time.
So you'll just begin to change your criteria.
We're going to begin to move away from those three categories to the neighborhood-specific variables. So that's going to be a very thoughtful process. We're going to be going back to the neighborhoods, soliciting their input on that. So it's an open-ended process.
And also, in general, you know, this change will be has to be approved by City Council to fully take effect. So the Housing Neighborhood Development Committee, on which I serve, will be looking at Dr. First's recommendations in the summertime. We'll have, you know, a general, you know, public meeting to adopt it and at which any citizen can sign up and speak on the subject, you know, before council takes final action on it.
And you have a website
yes.
that people can go and find more information about these meetings and other things as well.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mike. I always got to drive people to public information on the website. It's NBS for Neighborhood and Business Services, charlottenc.gov.
That's the problem with all government websites. They're indecipherable. Do it again, NBS.
NBS, Neighborhood and Business Services, dot charlottenc. I think you get that part, dot gov.
Yeah. Okay.
And I'll tweet about it, too, from time to time.
Okay, and we will put it up on our website as well. Warren Cooksey, City Council member from District 7. Dr. Owen Furseth, Associate Provost of Metropolitan Studies at UNC Charlotte, who leads this survey. And Virginia Keough, President of the Southwest Neighborhood Coalition. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Very welcome. From enriching lives by improving our quality of life to enriching the lives of young people through the performing arts, we're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about the Possibility Project. That's a nonprofit group that partners with CMS and particularly minority students to help them explore and discuss cultural issues through exposure to the performing arts. Nakia Weiler is managing and artistic director of the Possibility Project, who found her way into this, I think, surprisingly. This was not a career path move for you, was it?
No, not at all. And good morning.
Thank you
for having us, by the way, Mike.
You're welcome.
So, not at all. Actually, I laugh when you said broadcasting was your major. Corporate communications and broadcasting was mine. And so theater was never a background for me.
Right.
And also working with young people, definitely not. But what happened was I got acquainted with it through a friend of mine who's in Washington, D.C., who's now in New York running a Possibility Project program there. And I just walked into a room full of young people. I wanted to check out what he was doing. I walked into a room full of young people in Washington, D.C., 60 to 70, that were there. And I said, I have to do this work. It was the first time, especially being surrounded by teens, that I didn't feel afraid.
Really?
You know, it's very easy for people say all the time that it's very easy to walk into a room full of young people, teenagers, and you never know what you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked into that space and I never saw so much purpose and inspiration behind what they were doing and motivation and a very diverse group of people. You could tell who was dancing or who had that background or who had singing background or who had acting background or who wanted to do community work.
Well, let's introduce two of the teens that have been part of this Possibility Project here in Charlotte. Luke Lippert is a 16-year-old rising senior at South Mecklenburg High School.
Good morning.
Morning. And what do you bring to this process? Acting, singing, dancing?
Acting.
Okay.
Yes.
And we'll talk more about what you also bring to this project. And Austin Scott is 18 and a 2011 graduate of Harding University High.
Hello.
You've cut the strings, have you? You're moving on.
Yes, I am.
And what did you... And not a moment too soon.
No.
And what did you bring to the... what talent did you bring to this?
I originally brought acting and, you know, later on, singing, I eventually just broke out my shell a bit.
And is this something that you will pursue in the future, either professionally or as a hobby? Or
Everything, probably. I plan to be on the big screen, if that's what you're asking me.
Well, that's not exactly what I was asking,
okay.
but now I know, and I'll buy a ticket.
All right.
Okay. And Luke, what about you? I mean, you're 16, you've got several years left in high school. Is this something you want to pursue?
Definitely, like, if it's not my main thing, definitely on the side. I'm just not too sure yet.
Okay. We have to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about how this Possibility Project works here and around the country, because this is, what, six cities in the country?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. With these three individuals. So stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fisher & Phillips LLP, a national labor and employment law firm representing employers in North Carolina from the Charlotte and Columbia offices. Attorney Mike Honeycutt and Fisher & Phillips on the web at laborlawyers.com. Some states are passing laws that could limit voter fraud. Others claim they are thinly disguised efforts to disenfranchise certain groups of voters. How new voting rules could shape the 2012 election. That's the topic at 10 on the Diane Ream Show. And a reminder that WFAE's next public conversation will explore what life is like these days for 20-somethings. You can join us for this free community forum on Thursday evening at the Mint Museum Uptown. And you can get details and even register for the event on our website at WFAE.org. We're going to talk about kids and performance and what it does for them, the performing arts, that is, when we come back. Stay with us.
You know, I certainly like public radio more than I like the car.
It would actually be great to see, you know, some sort of flow chart that would say, you know, the muffler got sold, oh, we got this microphone cover. The stereo got sold, we got this trash can. The engine block was sold, we paid, you know, Peter Sagal's salary for about 25 minutes.
Hi, you're on Wait, Don't Tell Me.
My name is Matthew Lombra. I donated my 1998 Saturn SC2 to public radio.
Learn more at WFAE.org, and thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Nikia Weiler, who's the managing and artistic director of the Possibility Project, about the Possibility Project. Luke Lippert is with us, as is Austin Scott. Luke is currently in the program. Austin just graduated and is moving on to greener pastures. And there's an actual performance coming up on June 23rd and 24th at 8 at the McGlowan Theater here in Spirit Square called Breaking Character. How long has the Possibility Project been in existence here and then around the country? And then I think there's one in London as well.
Yes. Well, this is actually our 10th year. When I created it, it's been 10 years, founder of actually making it into a nonprofit organization here. Mm-hmm. But its beginnings happened in the mid-90s in Washington, D.C., as I described.
And the purpose of this is to combine the performing arts, whether it's acting or dance or singing or poetry, in fact.
Yes.
To give young people exposure to those art forms, but also to give them purpose, correct?
Absolutely. Our main mission or function for operating is really about that creative leadership.
Now, this is different, although it's similar, to giving kids access to recreation centers so they can play basketball, so they can play football, so they can learn other athletic activity. But this is a whole different endeavor, and it seems to me that it attracts a different crowd, or does it?
Well, it's interesting when they were talking about their background in acting. When I do go to schools and have partnerships with different agencies, I'm really looking for young people who are wanting to make a difference, wanting to learn how to use their voice. I'm not really necessarily looking for the most talented in a particular classroom. I'm really looking for a young person who needs a change of some type.
And when you say learns how to use their voice, you're mm-hmm. not talking about their physical voice. You're talking about their ways to express themselves,
yes.
to find their voice.
Yes, and I think physical voice also applies.
Okay.
I mean, taking a young person who is reserved in the back, I know Luke can relate to this, and, you know, having the confidence to actually physically use his voice and realize that voice behind it carries much power.
Let's talk about that, because I think you, Austin, mentioned that you kind of broke out of your shell, and then she's alluded to the fact that you are probably, you look like a quiet person to me.
Oh, well, sometimes. just with new people, you know.
What motivated the two of you, and I'll begin because he's closest to me, with Austin, to get involved in this?
Originally, just seeing Ms. Nakia for the first time in my theater arts class at mm-hmm. Hardin University High School. When she came in, it was just another atmosphere, just completely. I mean,
meaning what?
Such as she had us do an activity mm-hmm. where, like, the entire classroom got together and we had to piece together like, you know, like a rhythm, like a constant rhythm. Everybody had their separate like little different sounds that they all put together. And it's like 20-something people in the classroom. So when it all came together, it was like a song.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just amazing. It blew me away. And I was like, oh, this is hot. I want to be in this. You know? And, you know, and we were doing a public service announcement and on domestic violence.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I was acting, you know, mm-hmm. gave my apparently incredible, peace. And
this guy does not suffer from
no.
inferiority.
Not at all.
Yeah. She picked me up like the next day. I got a little sheet of paper that a lot of people didn't get in my classroom.
So this was like a little audition? Did they know
yes.
it was an audition?
No. Okay. I purposefully don't let people know who I am because
okay.
I'm trying to catch the essence of who the person is as
right.
opposed to them showing off to
okay.
me.
Okay. And what about you? What attracted you to this, Luke?
My theater teacher told me to have like a monologue ready for in my theater class because she said someone was coming. I don't know who, but I was just like, okay, I have a monologue ready. So I created something that kind of described somewhere I went from the past summer. And I was like out of my shell in my theater class, outgoing and everything. And it was the first time I did anything like serious as with acting. Like I always did comedy stuff. Yeah. And she liked me, so she invited me to come down. And when I went there, I was like, wow, this is crazy. Like, I was like, there's so many, like, open people with each other that I had never met before and people that were first-timers, and they were just so outgoing, and I was just, like, not ready to open up so
quickly.
Well,
this is interesting because both of you were in theater classes, and I would think some people that you recruit have no experience in that area at all.
No, not at all.
How come the people in your theater classes weren't open and outgoing like they were in the class that she recruited for the Possibility Project?
I will attempt to answer that.
Okay.
My theater class was kind of, you know, they kind of took it as a joke.
It's a crib class.
Huh?
It's a crib class. It's a class you can pass, you get an easy, quick grade.
Well, no, not necessarily, but it's like, you know, you can play and joke around as long as you actually do the assignment.
Right.
You know, they can tell when you're not really, you know, giving it your all. But then again, they let you play and make little comedy skits and everything like that. So that's basically why they didn't get taken seriously.
And you have said, Luke, this is the most diverse group of people you'd ever been with.
Yes, definitely.
How so?
For one thing, we all, like, there's not really like a, like, slanted school. Like, that's not like full of South Met kids or full of Myers Park kids. It's like divided evenly with different schools and different ethnicities, and like people have come in there and they play like a violin for their audition or something. Like there's just so many different people with different talents there.
Mm-hmm. When you get, how do you recruit these kids? You go, in this case, you went to Austin's drama class.
And yes.
Anonymously and did an exercise with him and were taking mental notes throughout the process and picked him, probably others.
Mm-hmm.
Luke's case, the students did monologues. But you don't just go to drama classes.
No, not at all. Actually, science classes and chorus classes.
What do you look for in a science class?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it depends on what's going on during that day. Actually, they were doing some sort of project where they had to present. So anytime I'm able to see young people in a particular class present something, that lets me know.
So what are you looking for in that individual? Whether, if they're presenting something in a science class or whatever, what are you looking for?
I am looking for a sense of story. I'm looking for difference. I'm also comparing up against the other schools that I've already attended. So if I have a certain sort of type of young person, it could be the more shy person. It could be the more outgoing young person.
Because that's my question. Because if Luke over here described himself as being kind of less than outgoing at the beginning, are you looking, do you want wallflowers? I mean, so that you can bring them out? Or do you want gregarious individuals because they bring everybody up?
And Mike, both. Because the wallflowers will learn from the...
I don't mean to call you a wallflower.
It's fine.
The wallflowers will learn from the outgoing. Uh-huh. And outgoing will learn from the quieter types because they'll learn how to reach out and connect with all sorts of people as opposed to people that are just like them.
And Austin, you say that this came along in your life at a time when you were trying to break out of either a gang experience or trying to avoid going into a gang experience. I'm not sure exactly which, but that seems like, either way, an enormous leap.
It was. I think I had just gotten out, and there was still, like, a lot of influences around me, simply because I had a lot of downtime, a lot of things that I wasn't doing, you know, with a large portion of my life. And once the gang part of it dropped out, it was like, well, what do I do now?
Right.
And there was still plenty of, like, little activities and stuff that I, you know, shouldn't have got into.
And how much of it is wanting to belong to something bigger than yourself?
I think it's a large portion of it. I think because in wanting to belong to something
you find out more about yourself.
And you've also said that prior to your experience with the Possibility Project that you didn't care about or like people in general, and that there were few positive influences in your life, and that with the Possibility Project you found an atmosphere of interesting, friendly people.
Yes, I did.
Interesting how?
Interesting as in, as Luke has put it, very diverse. There's, I mean, from the moment of, I stay in a black neighborhood, mm-hmm. and not really, around a lot of white people, mm-hmm. but that kind of just, blended all together, whether I had any say in it or not when I joined, the Possibility Project. And it was like I was either going to accept, mm-hmm. This different atmosphere, or, reject it and leave or something like that, which I wasn't going to do that. Of course not. I had to stay with them because, everybody's interesting.
Now, what did you do in your time in the Possibility Project? What kind of things did you work on?
Like the whole time, or like,
well, just what kinds of things do you do? And I know it leads up to this breaking character performance that's going to be at Spirit Square here in the next couple of days. But what kinds of things do you do? Because there are dancers, there are singers, there are actors, there are poets, etc. You don't all have the same talent, skills, or interests,
right? So how we actually come up with the show?
Yeah.
Okay, so we start off with the audition process where we get everybody that, in a set cast where we have 50 to 70 teens in one room.
It's unbelievable. And, it's an enormous bunch
yeah,
of people.
And
I love it.
So then we do warm-up activities and team-building exercises where we learn more about each other and each other's lives and what different problems we've gone through in our lives, because we have to come up with 3-minute scenes about maybe one person, or you can combine three people's different lives in one scene, just something that's affected them. And through that, the production team, a subgroup of the team, the whole team, they take notes during those scenes, so they know what actually reflects the group the most. And so what goes into coming up with the storylines for the whole play.
Hmm. Given the diversity that you talk about, are there enough common themes that run through all these diverse people that you can come up with?
Definitely.
What are the common themes?
One, personally, dealing with the gang aspect, mm-hmm. There are plenty of teenagers who have encountered, gangs or gang activity, and they have different experiences, of course, that, that they have, different outlooks. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting just to see how it all comes together when me being in a gang and being part of that gang activity versus somebody who was a victim of.
Mm. Wow. You have 70 or so students.
Yes.
Under your wing. And you meet, what, once a week, twice a week?
Well, I meet once a week with the larger company. And then the production team meets another date throughout the week.
And the production team, they're students as well, right?
Yes, they are.
And their job is to synthesize all the things that are coming out of the scene work.
Yes.
And come up with a script?
Yes.
A production, a show?
Well, they actually come up with the outline, and mm-hmm. the cast as a whole has to fill that outline in with the specific stories and narratives and poetry that will reflect each of those different topics.
Now, you're a graduate of Queen's University of Charlotte, yes. and you came at this from the corporate communications point of view. How did you get your head and your hands around this?
Wow, that's a great question.
This is a completely different universe.
Totally. But I think what corporate communications taught me is, and especially a little bit of organizational communications in that, is really about getting to know people. Mm-hmm. And that's what really attracted me to this whole idea.
It strikes me that you have to make yourself very vulnerable in these exercises that you go through, because mm-hmm. acting and singing and dancing is about failure. It's about trying things that aren't always going to work, and you're doing it in front of other people, and they might laugh at you.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you – that takes great courage. Where does that come from?
Most of that courage comes from the fact that you're in a room full of teenagers, mm-hmm. and, you know, what are you going to do to separate yourself from whatever would be, you know, considered, you know, a generic teen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody has a background. Everybody has a story. Everybody has something that they like to do. So what is it that, you know, what would I like to do? Mm-hmm. What would Luke like to do? You know, and you kind of just have to express yourself, because without it, you know, you end up falling into those lower ranks where, you know, not necessarily noticeable.
And I think the courage also comes in, even as I alluded to earlier, that idea of walking into a room full of teens with purpose, and the camaraderie that develops over the course of the programming together. I think the courage is found through, you know, knowing that what you're doing matters.
Hmm. And are both of you in the show that's going to be at Spirit School?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
All right. What are you doing in the show, Luke?
My role is he's a guy named Nicholas,
mm-hmm.
and he's kind of struggling with, I guess you could say, being a little two-faced with different, he has different, a lot of different environments in his life,
mm-hmm.
and having to adapt to those different environments. And he's having trouble with, you know, whether he should stay as the same person in all of his different environments, or if it's best to just make the best of his situations and stay there.
And I have about 15 seconds. What about you, Austin?
I play a coach, and I'm kind of stuck in between managing my basketball team. Of course, Nicholas is on it, and a lot of other problems.
Why is it called Breaking Character?
Well, the metaphor, it's about transforming and the young people learning how to either become themselves or deal with their different groups, and what it takes to not only break character, but also break character in your own life.
The Possibility Project's final performance of the year, the Breaking Character, is the 23rd and 24th at 8 in the McGlone Theater here at Spirit Square. Luke Lippert and Austin Scott will be in it, and Nakia Weiler is responsible for all of this. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You.